Good morning. I'm Dave Becht. This case breaks no new legal ground and can be decided by simple adherence to a uniform line of California precedent. Since at least 1962, California courts have uniformly held that the California Labor Code, regulations, and case law prohibit any deductions from wages unless the deductions are provided by statute and or unless the cost is caused by dishonesty or a willful or grossly negligent act of the employee.
Counsel, doesn't that depend on how you calculate the wages and at what point you begin to call something wages?
Not for purposes of a deduction. It does not. As Hudgens said, as Quillen said, that precise argument was raised by the defendant in Quillen. They said, we are not deducting these costs. In that case, it was shortages. We are just using it as one component in order to determine what is due.
Certainly in Ralph's, when the court approves the scheme in Ralph's, the plaintiff certainly could have looked at deductions from the profits of Ralph's grocery store as a deduction from wages to which they would otherwise be entitled. That was their argument. The court says no. We don't get to wages until we calculate the profits, and then we divide everything up here. And so why isn't the district court correct here that your client doesn't have wages until we've sort of figured out what he's brought into Bank of America?
Well, number one, Ralph's affirmed Quillen. It affirmed Hudgens, both of which said that this is just a clever method of circumventing California's definition of wages by saying it is just part of a calculation. It's not a deduction. They said it comes to the same thing. It is the same thing as far as we're concerned. Now, Ralph's, on the other hand, was a profit-sharing scheme.
This is a commission scheme, and Bank of America told your client up front what his commission would be based on.
Likewise, in Quillen and in Hudgens and in Care, the employee was told up front what the deductions were.
Those were not commission schemes, were they?
They were actually in Care. It was a commission scheme. In Quillen, they called it a bonus. The Court of Appeal in deciding that case said they call it a bonus, but it really comes to the same thing as if it was a commission. They are making a deduction of shortages from the wages of their employee, and that is illegal.
Mr. Beck, are you representing to us, in your view, the question before us is precisely the question in those cases?
Yes, I am. As the Court said in Rouse,
You sure probably want to qualify your answer. It's not the same, is it?
Well, the court in Rouse, our Supreme Court, said that those cases hold that any deduction wages.
So in other words, you're saying there's a difference, but there's a qualifier.
Well, if you're talking about the specific example involved, yes, but there is a difference. On the other hand, as our Supreme Court interpreted those cases.
I just misunderstood your answer. I thought you were saying there was no difference, that they were the same.
There are certainly overlaps in that we have shortages, for example, the fee application. If the fee application is not collected, it was charged dollar for dollar against Mr. Marr. That is the same thing, and I think it is the same thing as the shortage in the till in Care or the shortage in the till in Quillen. That is exactly the same deduction of the dollar for dollar. Now, there are other deductions here, but when our Supreme Court holds that these cases hold that any deduction is prohibited unless it's provided by statute or based on the dishonesty or gross negligence of the employee, then I take them at their word. Now, getting to Ralph's and your question.
Let me give you a hypothetical. Let's suppose we had a Fuller Brush salesman who gets a percentage of all that he sells. Now, if he goes out and decides to give away toothbrushes at the door because he thinks that that's going to be good advertising and that this will induce people to buy more sales, can the company deduct the cost of the toothbrushes from his commission?
If – well, that would be a willful act. It would be misconduct, and they could –
But why would it be –
At least arguably, they could say that this is a willful act of dishonesty
why would it have to
giving
be,
away
why,
our product.
Why would it be misconduct? What if Fuller Brush says, look, if you think you can sell – you think you can sell our product without giving away toothbrushes, you know, you're a great salesman and go for it. On the other hand, we do find that many of our salesmen can increase the total volume of their sales and increase their commissions through additional hard work by going out and giving out free samples of toothbrushes. If you want to do that, we are going to deduct that from your commission because it's a cost to us. But you may choose as to what you want to do.
No, I believe under California law, they could not charge him for the toothbrushes. They could not charge him for the loss, especially in your example.
It's not a loss.
Well, it is a loss in that they have a toothbrush that they're getting no
money. Right, but that's very different from merchandise shortages in the Quillen case and some of the other cases that you've cited.
It is still a deduction
from
wages.
This is willful. It's sort of a form of advertising. It's a way of inducing his clients to come to the table. That doesn't strike me as the same caliber of things such as merchandise shortages or breakage or things like that that are charged to employees.
Yes, under your example, it is a better example of what is not allowed because this, in your example, there is absolutely no negligence. There's no wrongdoing whatsoever on the employee's part. His employer has said this is one of the things that you can do to get more business for us. He is following his employer's option there. The employer cannot then turn around and say, but you, we are going to deduct this from your pay.
Even if they're told up front. Even if their salesman is told up front.
We've got great
toothbrushes that say, yes. Buy Fuller Brush products with your name and your phone number on them. But if you want to distribute them, as an aide here, if you think they're useful, we are going to charge that to you before we pay you your commission.
Even if they tell them up front, that was the holding of all of the cases, that whether or not they tell them up front does not make a difference. In Rouse, you may recall that the court gave an example of telling an employee up front that your wage will be $15 per hour minus $3 for each worker's comp claim that you file. The court said in that circumstance, the promised wage is $15 an hour, and the employer cannot deduct the $3 even if it announced its intention to do so up front. The fact that it's known to the employee does not matter. Hudgens said the one tool that is not available to an employer is to get an agreement with the employee to make illegal deductions. So whether there's notice, whether there's an agreement, there is no right to make those deductions. Now, one of the other things about Rouse is a profit-sharing plan. We, in contrast, the case we have here before us today is not a profit-sharing or even a profit based compensation plan. As the Rouse Court indicated, profits are determined by subtracting the store's operation expenses from store revenues. The plan they approved utilized profitability in the normal sense. In contrast, revenue was never part of the equation in the Bank of America plan. Mr. Marr was paid 0.7% of the amount of the loan, not the amount of the revenue generated. And, of course, the revenue would be much larger than the amount of the loan. In the normal calculation of profits, costs are subtracted from revenue. In the Bank of America plan, certain so-called costs were not subtracted from revenue. They were subtracted directly from Mr. Marr's compensation. Certain charges, like uncollected application fees, were subtracted dollar for dollar. Other deductions were a percentage of the amount under the plan. Mr. Marr bore a full 50% of all underages. In some cases, he bore the lion's share of the underages. And many deductions that were made by Bank of America were not cost at all, but rather frustrated wishes for greater revenue.
I want to wind up because you're over your time and you may want to have a word of rebuttal.
You're right.
Before you sit down, I've enjoyed your comments so far, but there's a preliminary issue that isn't really identified very carefully in the briefs, and that has to do with our jurisdiction. The order that you appeal from is not a judgment. And if that's true, we have no power to decide this case. I assume you've given some thought to that, and if you have an easy answer, I would welcome it. But I must say initially that I don't see the jurisdiction of our court.
The easy answer is if you look at the James case in which the partial summary judgment, just like this, was granted, the plaintiff dismissed voluntarily the remaining claims without prejudice, and the court said in order to deprive us of jurisdiction, there has to be one of two things. There has to be evidence of manipulation of the appellate process, which there is no evidence of that, or there's got to be danger of piecemeal litigation, go up and down. In this case, it's a stronger case than James because the remaining issues were resolved by settlement. There is no danger of repeated litigation. There is no other cause of action that's waiting in the wings for the outcome of this appeal. There is no manipulation here. We are simply appealing an adverse determination by the trial court.
I've read the James case, and I must say I find it an interesting case because it's so inconsistent with others of our cases. But the particular order that you appeal from can't even be considered a judgment, let alone what you do with it. It's merely an interim order that the district court ruled on. And then subsequent to your appeal, the district court filed another order in which he doubted anything that was going on was jurisdiction, and I can appreciate his concern.
Sure, and he cited the case dealing with an interlocutory order that they attempted to appeal. When you look at the cases dealing with partial summary judgments, that goes under the James rule of is there manipulation or is there a danger of piecemeal litigation, in which neither of those are present here.
Your argument, your brief said, well, we all knew what we were doing here. But that smacks of the idea that somehow you can stipulate yourselves to jurisdiction, which is contrary to our law completely.
Oh, and there is no secret plan. There is no secret stipulation here. There is no plan.
In your brief, you said we all wanted to bring this up. The parties can't stipulate to jurisdiction. You've got to find jurisdiction, and you've appealed from an order which is not a final order. Regardless of what you're trying to do, if it's not a final order, you can't bring it up, unless you can come within our injunctions, and this isn't an injunction suit. At any rate, you're going to rely on James only.
Well, and the case is cited by James, yes.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Good morning. Michael Weil for Bank of America. I will submit on the jurisdictional issue unless the panel has any questions about
submit
that.
Submit on the jurisdiction issue. What do you mean by that?
Submit on the papers that I have and address the underlying substitute.
Are you still taking the position that there's jurisdiction in this court?
We do not contend that there is jurisdiction in this court because this was subject to a settlement agreement under the Concha case. As we put in our briefs, that this case cannot be this court does not have jurisdiction over it.
Even the majority in the Concha case, with which I disagreed in dissent, would not find jurisdiction in this case.
And I would agree that there is no jurisdiction in this case.
You're still – you still have the jurisdiction issue in front of us.
Yes, I do.
And why is there not a final order when the district court clearly is done with the case and he's labeled something a judgment? And he said the clerk shall close the file. So what's left for the district court to do?
For this court here or for Judge Alsup to do or the district court?
The case sort of has to be someplace. So is it in the district court or is it here?
Well, based on how it was resolved itself and the stipulation that was entered into with dismissing certain claims without prejudice and certain claims with prejudice, based on my reading of Concha and some of the other case law, it appears that the jurisdiction – that this court does not have jurisdiction.
Okay. So does the district court have jurisdiction?
Presumably it does.
But then why did the clerk – why did the district court order the file closed? Clearly, Judge Alsup thinks he's done with this case, right?
Judge Alsup thinks he's done with
this
case.
Okay. And did you think you were done with this case when you entered into two stipulations with the other side?
I did.
In the district court?
A matter of law, I don't think this court has jurisdiction. At the time that
you didn't answer my question. My question was, did you think that you had resolved this case in the district court when you entered into two stipulations with the other side?
Yes.
Okay. Your intention was to be done in the district court and bring the matter on the summary judgment claims to this court.
Correct.
Okay.
That was the intention of the time.
So you've now crossed up the other side with your contentions about jurisdiction.
Well, the problem is it's a jurisdictional issue. The parties can stipulate to what they want to stipulate to, but if the court doesn't have jurisdiction, it doesn't have jurisdiction.
What are we supposed to do with the judge's first order, which says joint stipulation, re-dismissal, and entry of judgment? What else is Judge Alsup supposed to do here to finish this up?
Enter a judgment, I suppose. We've asked him to enter a judgment.
You're just looking for the separate piece of paper.
Yeah, to enter a judgment. There was no formal judgment entered. Both parties asked for a judgment to be entered. The issue of jurisdiction, the parties can stipulate to what they want to, including, for example, to extend the day to remove a case from state court to federal court, but that doesn't mean the federal court has jurisdiction agree.
When Judge Alsup says the clerk shall close the file and he says something that says entry of judgment, that's still not sufficient. We're still looking for one more piece of paper?
That is what we were asking for at one point in this case. Was looking for one more piece of paper. I understand that Judge Alsup dismissed the case upon settlement and didn't think there needed to be a judgment because his view is that they had been settled and there was a voluntary dismissal.
Okay. But it's clear that Judge Alsup would be surprised if he saw this case come back, right?
I think he would.
All right. So he thinks he's done with this.
Do you think he would, really? He says in his order here he's somewhat concerned. But that's the order that occurred after the appeal was taken. The appeal was not taken from that order. The appeal specifically was taken from his order of March 2. Isn't that correct?
Yes.
And so that is when everything stops. And then subsequently, Judge Alsup enters an order, but the appeal was not taken from that order. It was taken from the prior order.
Correct.
Okay.
Addressing the underlying substance of the appeal, the bank's plan has six attributes, I think, if you took a look at the body of case law, that takes it outside of the cases that the plaintiff was cited and puts it within a lawful plan. One is that it was a commission plan, that it was unlike the Quillian case and like some of the cases that the plaintiff was citing. Two, it was subject to contract. We cited the Kells case and the Steinhebel case that says the parties may agree to the contract about commissions, and that is what controls how wages are paid. Three, there were not secret deductions from any wages earned by Mr. Marr. As the Rouse case discussed, the purpose of 221, of Section 221, was to prevent secret deductions or fraud on the employees. We do not have secret deductions here because how Mr. Marr's commission was going to be calculated was set forth in the commission plan itself. He had access to those documents. He had access to the calculator that was used in his region on how his commissions were going to be calculated. There was nothing secret about it. Four.
Well, you confused me, and I didn't come here confused. I thought I understood where we were. If you are now making an argument, but if you firmly believe this Court has no jurisdiction, what do you think we must do?
Well, I have two separate bases in my argument. One is jurisdiction, and one is the substantive issues of the – if the court believes it has jurisdiction, then I've got to address the merits of the appeal.
We won't believe we have jurisdiction unless we do, but as I understand it, the court – there are certain rulings that the court made. Isn't that right?
That the district court made, yes.
Yes. And I assume those rulings will stand unless there's jurisdiction to appeal them. And I gather your position is what?
My position, number one, is there's no jurisdiction to appeal, but if there is jurisdiction to appeal, if this court believes that it has jurisdiction over this case, then I'm
– Well, we won't believe it unless there's a basis for it.
Right. And – but if the court can – believes that there is a basis for it of jurisdiction in this case, then I'm addressing the substantive issues that underlie this appeal with respect to the commission plan. So there's a twofold argument that we've presented in our briefs and as I'm presenting today. And the second argument is dealing with the underlying commission plan. And one of the other attributes of the bank's commission plan that puts it outside of the cases that the plaintiff has cited and makes it a lawful plan, the fourth attribute, is that the calculation itself was tied to and attributed to the specific mortgage loan officer. So if Mr. Marr was not an insurer of the mistakes of other employees, unlike what happened in Neiman Marcus' case where the employees were responsible for the mistakes of others. Mr. Marr was not being punished, or the bank was not punishing all employees for the sins of few, as it came out of one of the cases that was the concern. He was responsible for his mortgages. If he wanted to waive a fee in order to bring that mortgage in, that was what he was. That's what he did. If there was a rate lock failure in a mortgage that he was responsible for, then based on that rate lock failure, his commission was adjusted. He was not responsible for the adjustments made to his colleagues. That number five, another attribute, he had control over the cost. The Division of Labor Standards Enforcement made this a point, and this is the administration that's responsible for enforcing the laws in California distinguished a plan in the letter that was cited to the court, is that there was, in that situation, the mortgage loan officer had control over the cost. Mr. Marr had control over the cost. Unlike the cases, the Kurz case and these other cases, where those employees did not have control over the cost because it was attributed to other employees. And five, it's not the adjustments to Mr. Marr's commissions or the way it was calculated was not due to unforeseen circumstances. That was another purpose of Labor Code Section 221, as discussed by the Rouse case, is to prevent unanticipated or undetermined deductions to the wages of wage earners who rely on those wages to pay for their daily or monthly expenses, and they had some sort of expected amount that they would bring in the door. That is not the situation with the bank's plan. It was not due to some unforeseen circumstances. In fact, it was foreseen circumstances that was in Mr. Marr's control. If he wanted to waive a fee, that's what he did. If he wanted to lower an interest rate and with bank approval, that's what he did to bring it in. If his loan, there was a misquote on the rate, then he could see that coming because he was responsible for the quoting on the rate. If there was a rate lock failure, that was in his control. He was responsible for his mortgages. That's not an unforeseen circumstances. And with those six attributes that are specific to this plan, puts it outside those cases cited by the plaintiff and it is a lawful plan under California law.
Back to the question of jurisdiction before your time expires. If we were to find that there's no jurisdiction here for us to hear the appeal, what do you say to Judge Alsup? What do you say when Judge Alsup says, what are you doing here?
If we go back to Judge Alsup, it would be to resolve what's outstanding in this. I think what is in the stipulation, there were certain things that were dismissed without prejudice, and those things need to be dismissed with prejudice in order for this court to have a jurisdiction. And these were claims that were, it's a complicated procedural posture, but from my perspective, they were phantom claims that were never asserted in the original complaint to begin with. We moved for partial summary judgment. Both sides moved for partial summary judgment. Plaintiff contended that there were certain claims within the complaint that we said just weren't there, and Judge Alsup agreed with the defense that the claims that the plaintiff was asserting in this case were not encompassed within the complaint that's in his order. And so what was being partially carved out for appeal and what was being dismissed without prejudice were these phantom claims. It might as well
that may or may not have existed.
That it, they might as well said that there's a claim for age discrimination in this complaint. It's just not there. But as far as the stipulation, in order to get this case resolved, we said, okay, if you this claim is not there, and in the stipulation say we do not agree that this claim is there, but okay, dismiss it without prejudice if that's what suits you, and so we can move forward with this case. But it's those phantom claims, I think, that have to be dismissed with prejudice for this case, to, for this Court to have jurisdiction.
Thank you. I'm going to allow you 1 minute. And I'd like you to address sort of the similar question. If we were to find that there's not jurisdiction, what has to happen when you go back to Judge Alsup?
I guess what would have to happen is we would go back to Judge Alsup, and he would create that one more piece of paper where he would say, again, judgment, and again, we would then bring it back up to here, and that would cause the piecemeal litigation that we're trying to avoid.
If we were to decide that you did, that we did have jurisdiction to hear your appeal, and we decided these claims against you, the Ralph's claim and the unfair business practices claims, we were to affirm the district court's judgment on summary judgment on those two claims, is there anything left of this case?
No, there is not.
Okay. You don't have another lawsuit. You don't have other claims that are pending. The case would be over.
Well, there is the ERISA claim that was dismissed without prejudice because it was not ripe. So that is totally a separate thing.
And you would have to file a new lawsuit.
Correct.
Okay. So you have to start all over again.
But we will in any case.
But this case would be over if we decide these claims against you.
You are correct.
Okay.
Do you really read his order as saying that all he would do is put in another piece of paper if he had? He went along with the stipulation. That's clear from his order.
But he called it, he says judgment, he says close the file.
He said close the file. That's what
and
he said.
And he believes he is done with this case. And so we're in limbo, essentially.
No, you're not in limbo. You could have done it differently. He knew what conscience said. And he let you go if you want to go, but that he said he had no jurisdiction. I don't think you can read that in Judge Alsup. He's a very smart judge. He knew exactly what you were trying to do, and he let you do it in case you could get by us up here.
He knew the Concha, dealing with an interlocutory order, what that said. Now, what James said, and it distinguished cases like Concha that dealt with interlocutory orders.
It did not distinguish Concha.
It did not.
It was not an in-bank case, even though the chief judge wrote it. We have to be able to follow Concha.
You are correct. He did not. It did not distinguish Concha. It did distinguish two other cases that dealt with interlocutory orders. It says that is a different situation than a partial summary judgment. Now, one other very brief point. The bank is arguing this case as if this is one of first impression. He gives six different things, all those factors that he has cited. The commission, which was the case in CARES Catering, was a commission case. It was subject to contract. That was the case in CARE. Quillian and Hudgens, all of them were written contracts. It was not a secret contract.
I think we understood those points. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your indulgence.
All right. We thank both counsel for the argument.